So thanks a lot for being here. What I will talk about today is mostly work that I've done in Edinburgh, where I was doing my postdoc with Mike Cates until 2011. And now I'm back in Paris. I sit in Université Paris Diderot and got a senior position. And so we'll basically speak about effective temperature, or let's say steady states of active particles in an electrode potential in the first half of the talk. And in the second half of the talk, I'll turn to interacting self-propelled particles. So I probably don't need to say why active matter is a very exciting field. Probably from the point of view of physicists, I mean, all these systems were studied before we called them active matter. And probably the only thing which is a bit new is the interest of physicists. And it stems from mostly three reasons. The first one is that they have very rich phenomenology. So StatMech told us that simple microscopic dynamics can have complex microscopic behaviors. Complex matter systems told us that complex microscopic dynamics can do too. But what's interesting about the systems is that you don't need complex microscopic dynamics to get interesting microscopic behaviors. Very simple models can capture this. So of course, theoreticians are very excited about that. But what's really refreshing in StatMech is that you can really go from simple models down or up to experimental realizations. So you can really cover the whole field of StatMech, and you're not stuck either with very simple lattice models which have no experimental counterparts, or with very complicated experiments that you cannot understand. And of course, as physicists, what StatMech physicists, what interests us is whether all these systems should be studied separately, and in which case maybe there shouldn't be an active matter community, or whether we can really build up generic description. So why should there be generic description? If these things are all on equilibrium, in principle, everything is lost and there is no hope. Nonequilibrium physics is like non-elephant biology. There is no reason why there should be just one theory of it. And just on this slide, I'd like to say why I think there is some room for genericity, or maybe the previous slide was why is soft matter, why is active matter interesting? This slide is why should it also be a bit boring. So if you take the Jean Perrin experiment, you have a cuvette, you fill it with water, you put colloids and passive colloids, you let them sediment. In principle, you should solve the dynamics to compute steady state, but you know you don't have to do that. StatMech tells you that you can simply compute the partition sum and that the steady state density profile will be an exponential atmosphere. So as far as static properties are concerned, this is much simpler. You can get rid of the dynamics. Now make a tiny difference. Rather than having Brownian particles, look at bacteria. So these are also colloids. They don't do Brownian rondumo. They do another type of rondumo, but it's not that different. And very certainly, if active matter was completely different, just because you've made small microscopic modification on the random walk, everything should be lost. You shouldn't be able to know if there exists a steady state. And even if it exists, you're told that you have really to solve the dynamics to compute it, which is really something a bit stupid to do, and that you lose all the tools. And so one hope is that at least on some level, you can retain either a bit of similar physics. If I look at angstrom level at the motion of colloids, at the end of the day, it's not that different from Brennan and Tumble. And hopefully that we can use similar methods in the sense that everything we've built for equilibrium physics may be not lost. Of course, if you answer yes to both questions or no to both questions, you don't have something very interesting, but basically two parts of the talks will be saying yes to this question while this doesn't work, and then saying yes to this question while this doesn't work. Right. So I will very briefly present the two types of active particles I look at in these talks, rental bacteria and active Brownian particles. And then the two parts will really be steady state in external potentials, in dilute suspensions, meaning that I will neglect most interactions. And the second part will be about interacting particles. And if you have any questions at any time, feel free to interrupt me. Otherwise, I'll just speak faster and faster and faster. So that's your only hope. Right, so Brownian tunnel bacteria. You've heard a lot about them last week. So these guys are colloids, typically microliter sized. Big difference with passive colloids is that they have this flagella that they use to swim, and here this electron microscopy picture of E. coli. So how do these guys swim? They can do two things. Either they rotate all the flagella counterclockwise, and then people believe that there is a hydraulic coupling that makes the flagella bundle. It makes a corkscrew. You rotate the corkscrew in very viscous conditions, and the bacterium goes forward. And then from time to time, one or more flagella can change direction. That's what people call a tumble. Typical frequency is 1 per second. Typical velocity is 20 micrometers per second. And then the bacterium changes direction. So this is a movie that was done in Edinburgh by Martin Mead during his PhD. Oh, that should be looking. That would be really painful. Okay. So bacterium was arriving here. Here you can see that the bundle starts breaking. You can see that the bundle has spread in basically three parts. And then the bacterium will start in a new direction once the bundle reforms. So for practical purpose, this tumble can be assumed to be almost instantaneous. And just at the end of the talk, I'll speak a bit about fine aggregation tumble. If you put these two ingredients together, what you get is a non-equilibrium random walk. It's a kind of relay random walk, where you have Poisson distributed step in one direction, and then sudden change in another direction. So this is what I will call Renan tumble particle. It's close, but less complicated than the real thing, which also has a bit of Brownian diffusion, which has correlations between the ingoing directions and the outgoing one, which I will neglect in all the talk. And then if I look at what happens with these rules at large scales, if these steps are Poisson distributed, then I get diffusive behavior. I can compute the diffusivity. And what's important is that it's roughly three orders of magnitude larger than the diffusion constant of a dead bug, which means I can really neglect the translational diffusion constant of these guys. The second type of particles, which I didn't really study initially, they didn't exist when I started my postdoc, is what is now actually much better controlled probably than the first one, is that what people call self-propelled colloids or active Brownian particles. So they are made in a number of ways. The one I know best is this one. So it's you take latex beads and you coat half the beads with metallic alloy like platinum, which catalyzes the transmutation of hydrogen peroxide that creates a gradient along the cell body, and the cells are self-propelled. People believe they are propelled in this direction, but actually they cannot check whether that's the case or not. The typical speed is slower than that of bacteria. I think now they can go up to like 6 or 7 micrometers per second to have found better particles. Again, nevertheless, the active diffusivity is larger than the passive diffusivity. Here there is just like one order of magnitude, so it starts to be more comparable. But again, really what you need in this case is rotational diffusion in your modeling. So you don't have tumbles, you don't change instantaneously your direction, you have a slow drift of the direction of motion. So that's the fancy version, which was published last year. So these guys, they are latex bead. The black dots are small cube of hematite, which catalyzes the transmutation of hydrogen peroxide just when you shed blue light. So by turning light on and off, you can control when the particle starts moving or when they stop.
Can you only decide yes. when they start moving, or can you also decide the velocity?
No, when they stop. So the thing which is a bit complicated is that, so these guys, they create a gradient of chemicals that make them move. When you turn off the light, they stop creating the gradients, but the gradients are still there for some time. Mm-hmm. And because people cannot see really these gradients and measure them, it's very difficult to understand what's going on.
But she was asking if you control the speed.
Oh, the speed, sorry. Yeah, you can change the speed with intensity of the light. Sorry. Yeah. The concentration of hydrogen peroxide and intensity. I think you're limited because if you make it too much, you get bubbles, and that's a problem.
And these are not like 10
microseconds. Yeah, these are even faster. These were the very first generation of the.
Can you recover the color that makes it different?
Probably, at least in the movies, it's clear that there is a huge difference. Right. So, as you've seen, next slides, I will constantly hop back and forth between the two particles. I'll even tend to forget sometimes to tell which particles I'm speaking about. And the reason is that at large scale, these things have common properties. Now, it's not very surprising. You say, oh, I have something which is diffusive, so large scale will be characterized by a diffusion constant. Maybe there will be some drift force. If I do a kind of Landau expansion at large scale, I know the type of equations I will get. I will get a mass conservation equation, and my flux, well, typically there will be a diffusion term, and maybe if there are some interactions or some non-uniformity in these parameters, I'll get some drift. But that should give me similar type of physics. But actually, you can ask the question in a bit more precise way. You can wonder whether these things are not just qualitatively equivalent, but quantitatively equivalent, in the sense that I have these microscopic parameters. So for hot colloids, I will have, say, you know, if temperature is fixed, at least I have the viscosity. Remnant tumble particles, I will have the swim speed and turning rate. Active remnant particles, I will have self-propulsion speed, translational diffusivity, rotational diffusivity. And I can wonder whether by adjusting this microscopic parameter, I can exactly map this microscopic transport coefficient so that really the different microscopic model goes grain into exactly the same equations. And as you will see, in some cases you can, in some cases you can't. And I'm not just saying this and that guy, but also with equilibrium balance. Right. So first I'll consider external potential. So how do you describe the dynamics of these guys? Well, you write down master equations. So you say probability of finding one particle at position x going in direction u evolves as time goes on. There is one term which is advection of probability along the velocity vector, which may or may not be parallel to the direction to which you're looking at. Then if you have tumbles, you have a loss term. You were at the good position, looking in the good direction, and you tumble away from it. And then you have gain terms, which is that you are at the good direction, looking in the wrong, in the good position, looking in the wrong direction. You've tumbled in the good way. So you have like 1/(ω), which is the solid angle probability of ending up in the good direction. And if I want, I can add rotational diffusivity. So that would be the angular part of the Laplacian acting on u direction. And that's rotational diffusion, and then I can also have translational diffusion constant. So in principle, I take an external potential, which will affect, you know, mostly my velocity, will have a Stokes drag, and I solve this equation. And then, for instance, I average over the direction. I go see my experimentalist colleague and say, can you measure this density profile?
It's about
V? Yes.
Yeah.
V here is the self-propulsion speed of a given particle. So in principle, there is one bit, which is the self-propulsion speed. You're looking at the direction going there. And then if you have an external potential, you have also a Stokes drag.
Okay, but
it's a microscopic. Yeah, that's a one particle problem. It's a microscopic master equation. Not necessarily. If you're trying to swim in a swimming pool and you have, let's say, you know, some concrete attached to your feet, you may look in one direction, but you will go in another. So if you have an external potential, your velocity vector is the sum of where you're trying to go and the external force.
I understand, but in the absence of any
external force. Yeah,
But just to be clear, so in this case, there is a constitutive relation between there's a constitutive relation between V and U that you have time.
Yes, yes. And then I will.
So dt and dr is the...
So that would be translational diffusion constant and rotational diffusion.
But does it follow the Stokes rule, right?
Yeah, in principle for the...
dt is 1/r and
so
dr
so
is
it, yeah, it depends a little bit what you're looking at. So for instance, for people who model remnant of the bacteria, when they are in the turning state, the bacteria are changing direction, but they're changing direction much faster than with rotational diffusion. It's like active diffusion.
But is it active rotational diffusion constant or just a passive diffusion constant, the dr?
So again, it depends a little bit what you're trying to model. So if I'm trying to model active gradient particles, that would be passive diffusion. And dt would also always be the passive. Okay, so the simplest case you can look at is when everything is constant, so uniform, and isotropic. In this case, what you do is you integrate the master equation over U, you make a long-term approximation, and what you recover is just a diffusion equation. And the only thing you gain is that you have an explicit expression for the diffusivity, which is a sum of two terms. One here is a passive diffusion constant, and the other one is the active contribution. So you have V squared, the swimming speed squared. The D is the number of special dimension, and you have the sum of two terms here. One comes from the tumbling, and the other one comes from the rotational diffusion. So there is nothing very special about this formula. Maybe it wasn't so obvious that they should, these guys should just sum up, and that these terms should sum up in the denominator.
So
that's
the one for Schnitzel, right?
Yes.
So here you have DT and DR.
I don't remember precisely. I don't know if you had DT and DR.
Yeah.
So you have, he has the V square over the alpha.
He looked very similar.
Yes. Yeah. So I think he had V square over alpha D.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he had these guys.
In the approximately.
Yes. Yes, it's
expansion in what quantity?
Time. So it's time larger than 1 over alpha, 1 over DR. You are assuming fast variable treatment for the orientation for the probability current.
Appropriate question.
Yes.
So this alpha is a turning rate. That's different
yes.
from dr, which is rotational diffusion.
Yes.
So what's the difference, physically speaking?
Well, that the bacteria, they so in the bacteria, if you want, the biologically, what they do is that they swim. Of course, when they swim, there is also rotational diffusion. And then there is this biological process where they just stop, change direction, and resume. And they do that really rapidly. It's like 0.1 seconds, while they swim for 1 second. So you have like this sudden kind of uniform loss of change of direction, as opposed to the gradually continuous change of direction. So at this level, you have a very trivial result, which is that if you're looking at active brilliant particles or remnantable particles or hot colloids, at large scale, everything is uniform isotropic, you get a diffusion equation. So you can, of course, adapt the microscopic parameters that they all give you the same D. But there is nothing special here. You just have one microscopic transport coefficient. You have a number of microscopic ones. It's obvious that you can all make them, choose them all equal. What will be much less trivial afterwards is that you can, at some level, retain that when also you have a drift. And that will come at the end of the talk. So now what happens when you have the external potential? Well, now I will assume that these external potential don't affect tumbling rate and rotational diffusion, and that can be discussed, at least for bacteria, it should be discussed probably. And the major difference I'll focus on is what happens to the velocity. So that's the bit that I wasn't showing you earlier, that your velocity is the sum of the self-propulsion force where you're trying to go, and Stokes speed, which is where the external potential are trying to take you. So typically, the Stokes speed will be a mobility minus the mobility times the gradient of an external potential. So if you have colloids at equilibrium, then you know that in the steady state, the distribution will simply be exponential minus this external potential divided by the temperature. And the question is what happens when you have bacteria or active brilliant particles. All my work was done on bacteria. At the time, I didn't know about active brilliant particles. So for the next few slides, I will focus on the remnantable particle case. But I will show you experimental results for these guys. So the first thing we solved was the sedimentation profile in all dimensions. And here you can get an exact solution. So
So here you're relaxing the, having the velocity, lock the velocity of what's around it.
Yes.
And you're doing it in what I might call a conservative way, with potential. You could have a dissipative way as well, like if you're swimming across a river, where the flow of the river is due to an external potential, but around you, the river is not.
Yes, you mean I'm not taking into account the possibility of external flows. Yes. Here I'm just looking really, because I want to do the Perrin experiments. So I want to
The description end up being the same?
You need to have an external field. Can you go back? Well, if you want to go back. You mean this?
Yeah.
No, you would have something different here.
Right.
That's fine. But you know, even in this case, you cannot always solve it. So the big surprise in the case where you look at sedimentation is that you still have Perrin profile. And when you want to compute the inverse sedimentation next lambda, it's not simply related to the external potential. It's a solution of a transcendental equation, which is not very inspiring. There is one case, though, in which things simplify a lot. It's when the sedimentation speed is very small compared to the swim speeds. And the good news is that, you know, this is 10 minus 2 for bacteria. So if you're doing experiments, that's a good news. At least as long as you don't centrifuge them. And in this case, the solution of this at first order is simply lambda equal Stokes drag, Vito, divided by D naught, which is the diffusion constant of bacteria in the absence of external potential. And so if now I can look at the full solution of my steady state distribution, and I see that here I really recognize something which is equilibrium-like. I want to read D naught over mu as a Stokes-Einstein relation backward that I would use to define an effective temperature. And then this P is simply the same distribution as the one I would get for colloids, just with a temperature which is much larger than room temperature. So here I've done that for
this,
yes.
This is a single fact, right?
This is a single population. There are no interactions so far. So here I'm showing this for sedimentation. Actually, you can show that the existence of this effective temperature regime holds for generic potential. And in a second, I'll speak about trapping, what happens in harmonic traps.
Can you say a little bit
yes.
about what kind of calculation you have to do?
Yes. So it's a bit painful. So it's not, you don't solve this. For some reason, it doesn't work. What you do is you assume you're in a steady state, and you write a self-consistent equation on the distribution of particles. You say that all particles at a given position at some time have had their last tumble at the time two in the past. They were at another direction. They haven't tumbled since, so you know the equations. And so you just write the fact that you integrate over all possible time since your last tumble. You get a linear integral equation that you can solve by Laplace Fourier transform. It's a bit like a Dyson relation. When you make these Dyson loops, and the thing is that in steady state, so that gives you know, the propagator as the convolution of the propagator with the previous steady state distribution. It's linear, and because the propagator is very simple in this case, you can just solve it. But for instance, in harmonic trap, in 1D you can solve it, in 3D I couldn't manage. So it's not very powerful as a way to solve things. But you can get a bit more than that, actually. You can even solve P of Z theta, so you can have the full angular distribution. Of the, yes.
You solve this in effective temperature.
Yes. And the reason I'm doing that is because there is a property of the bacteria, which I measure, which is D naught, and the mobility. I divide D naught by mu, I get a number. Every time I apply an external potential, whatever the external potential, if it's perturbative, I will get the Boltzmann distribution with this temperature.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but I was just saying, why is it actually an effective temperature? Because if D naught is the ordinary diffusion, then it's KT divided by a drag, and the drag is set by the same viscosity as mu, so it's actually the real temperature. Mm-hmm.
No, D naught is the effective.
D
naught is V square over D alpha. It's this guy.
Is this really surprising at the level of a simple particle? The system really does behave as well with that. One particle.
I think that what I'm doing here is saying that in the random double dynamics, there is nothing that breaks time reversal. And if I look at a colloid, as long as I have scale separation between the scale at which I apply potential and the collision at which I receive the kicks from the liquid, then I know I end up with this Boltzmann weight, and which is why it works also here. The difference that here you break that at the scale of the colloid, while for the colloid you break this at the scale of the liquid. But the thing which is not completely trivial is that in the run and tumble dynamics, you don't have detail balance. And so it's
no, I understand that, but you know, even then
if I look at the steady state distribution of these particles trapped in the quartic potential, I have this. I can measure entropy creation, and there's a positive rate of entropy creation, which is a bit counterintuitive. So that's the, what this means to be at equilibrium in this case is not very clear for me.
No,
right
I
now.
Don't mean that, I agree that that's not obvious, but the fact that you can make this look like a temperature for one particle, I think that comes out.
But it's an effective temperature for the steady state distribution. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily
yes.
a temperature for the dynamics of the
thing. No.
The long time.
Yeah. Of course, I can do FDT around these things, and it would work. But yeah. So just one word of experiments. This is the work done by Jérémy Palacci during his PhD at Lyon. That sedimentation profile, the height. You have the semi-log scale, you have nice straight slopes. This is a check of the effective temperature regime, so that the inverse sedimentation length versus DF, so the fact that it's linear, so it's DF over the slope is Vito, basically. Unfortunately, in this case, they didn't manage to go in the case where you have something which is not an effective temperature, so it would be interesting. And one of the things that you get in this case is you need to have gravitational collapse. So when Vito becomes equal to V, even the bacteria traveling upwards go downwards. So the whole profile should collapse. And here they're very far from this regime, and that's something that they're looking at now.
So what's 1 over lambda for physical
equilibrium? That's a good question. I don't remember.
I think it was like around 1 millimeter or something like that. It was pretty big because I wanted to do experiments and I started reflexing. Pivot field with 1 centimeter of stuff, and I have to wait like 24 hours for the sediments. And then bacteria and all kind of things in the meantime. I don't remember the number, sorry.
Right. So that's, you see, it's a different system. Now it's active brilliant particles, but you get the same large scale behavior. And one case which is slightly more interesting and which will be reminiscent of things you've heard last week is what happens when you trap bacteria. So basically now, here it's the 1D case. I'll show you the 3D afterwards, because that's the one we can solve exactly. So you have left and right moving velocities, which are V plus or minus lambda X. So X is the distance with the center of the trap. The problem here is quite different from the case of sedimentation, because if you swim really away from the center of the trap, there is a distance, V over lambda, at which this force exactly cancels that force. So if you just keep swimming straight, there will always be one place where the force will not be perturbative. And so you could wonder whether there can be a perturbative regime in this case. You can solve the steady state distribution. It has a bit this weird form. Nevertheless, again, you have an effective temperature regime. And now you have basically two constraints. The first one is, as I said, that lambda x should be much smaller than V. So the Stokes flow is much smaller than the swim speed. But for that to be possible, actually, which means that you swim really fast, so you should be crossing the trap. But in order not to arrive in this region where this term is beyond that one, you have to change directions really often. So you're going really fast, as opposed to the Stokes drag, but since you're changing direction of the time, you don't move very far. And at the end of the day, what you get is a Gaussian distribution. Again, you get the effective temperature. You make simulations, numerical exact solution, and diffusive approximation overlap perfectly. Now, if you look at this distribution, what you can see is that if I increase the strength of the trap, lambda, this guy here can be equal to 1. And so 1 minus 1 gives 0, which means that this should be a constant, which is very surprising. Make simulations, and indeed, you get something which is completely constant. Of course, here it falls to 0. But within the trap, the bacteria is delocalized. If I keep on increasing lambda, this becomes negative. And so what happens is that now, things start to diverge close to the boundary. And what is happening here, actually, is what Gerhard Gomper was a bit describing yesterday, and I think also what's happening in the segregation experiments, that in this case, the bacteria, the typical run length is much larger than the size of the trap. So
So you go forward until you stop. You spend a long time there. You tumble. You go forward.
You cross the trapping, and that basically, with any confinement, you should end up in this type of region, and so you'd have a like depletion in the center and accumulation close to the boundaries. So in 3D, we didn't manage to solve it exactly. You can check that the effective temperature regime still exists, so there is still the Gaussian, and that's just a Jacobian. You can make simulations, so this is density divided by Jacobian versus distance to the trap squared, so the straight line semi-log. The straight line means it's a Gaussian, maybe not the best way of showing it. That's for strong trapping, and again, you see you have something which is flat, and you accumulate close to the wall. So here you see that before the sedimentation case, we always had Perrin profile. So the only thing that the existence of effective temperature was telling you, or the failure of the effective temperature was telling you, was that you had quantitatively a difference. Here, qualitatively, you have a big difference. And with this, I go back to Peter's question. These things live in the fluid. They push on the fluid. In this case, what happens is that they all swim outwards. So if you have a number of particles which all swim outwards, they're all pointing outwards, trying to push fluids inside. And this is what you get. So you have a self-assembled pump. So this is initial condition. It's disordered. As time goes on, they all try to swim outwards. So each cone is one bacterium. That's this direction. Color code of the cone is particle density, and you will see the fluid flow here. So here you have basically like a sphere with all particles pointing outwards, all of them trying to push fluid inwards. That's a mechanic equilibrium, but it's unstable. If you have some place slightly denser, and that's what happens here, they will start to create a flow. This flow will rotate these guys, which are then whose velocity is not compensated anymore by the trapping. They will go from here to there, and you'll have like a kind of pump which creates, which goes on and on. So Holger Stark just put so here we did some numerical simulations with hydrodynamics, and when I say we, it means Rupert Nash. We could do the linear stability analysis, but not say much more about that. And Holger Stark had done a work recently on Brownian particles, where they can go much further in terms of analytics. Right, so before I finish this first part, I'll just want to mention another case in which the breakdown of equilibrium is very interesting. That's the experiment of Bobastien. You heard about it last week. So you have a 2D microfluidic cavity, asymmetric obstacles. Particles can easily go this way, it's more difficult that way. Put colloids, you have just Brownian Boltzmann distribution. Put bacteria, you fish them. So we were wondering what kind of ingredients you need in your model to understand that. And actually, in addition to the run and tumble dynamics, there is at least one thing you have to do, which is what bacteria do when they collide with a wall. So at the time, there was a big discussion about the effect of four-field hydrodynamics. I really didn't want it to have to simulate that. So we just put a camera on top of a wall. And look at what happened. What you will see is that most of these guys swim like that. And some are less shy than the other, and so we'll collision here, and you'll see what happens. Is that basically just completely collide with the wall, push a little bit, then feel a torque because of the closed field, and swim along the wall. And we were wondering, well, is it sufficient to reproduce the experiments? So what we did was a simulation in which we have 1,000 rental particles which align with the rules when they hit the walls, and the only rules we added was you just follow the wall afterwards. And all the geometry numbers are the same in the experiments. And as you can see, as time goes on, this density builds up. And the thing that was a bit surprising for me is that actually the ratio of the density that you get is 3, and the experiment is 2.7. So with this very simple model, no interactions, no hydrodynamics, nothing, just aligning with the wall and run double dynamics with the good numbers, you get the good density ratio.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What did you do to get out of the edge of these
What do you mean? Here?
Yeah, here.
I'm following it. So actually, if you get stuck here, the efficiency of the trapping is much, much lower. So you really have to say that you follow the wall. And I think that one of the differences, for instance, they really did the experiments with C. elegans, not with bacteria, and with C. elegans, they couldn't measure any difference of density. And when you look at the pictures, you see that the worms, they are a bit trapped here. They don't just like go away. And
that seems to
impact a lot. The details of the interaction with the wall are important. But then you remember last week there was this topic with Chlamydemonas, who follows also the wall. And of course, you get the same result because you have the same ingredient. One thing which is slightly nice is that, so what I've told you so far is that there is nothing on equilibrium in the run and tumble dynamics. So of course, microscopically, it's fueled by nuclear motors, and being good, the fuel is non-equilibrium, but by the time you're just looking at the trajectory, I'm saying there's nothing that breaks down time reversal symmetry. And here, the only thing which actually ends up breaking this time reversal symmetry are the interactions with the wall. So if you look at the blue trajectory, the probability of the forward trajectory is simply there has been not unknown. Well, the probability of the backward trajectory would require exactly one tumble here in the good direction. One way of testing that is that if you replace this rule by elastic collision, so you keep running tumble but with elastic collision with the rule, then the ratio of density as function of the velocity is this purple line, which is flat at one. Well, the run and tumble does that. And so the experiment is around here.
So does the ratio?
Yes. Sorry.
Does it depend on the shape of on the
yes.
geometry of the bar?
Yes. So if you scale everything from, you know, as you would expect, sure. That's fine. But yeah, basically the if so for the lengths of these arms are comparable with the run lengths, and if you make the run lengths much, much smaller, then the density goes back to one, and you're kind of going back to, you know, local Brownian motion. So that's the.
I'm doing
covariant
dynamics. What does it mean, elastic collision?
Oh, nothing. No. Yeah, you're right. Again, you're asking me, can I create a real particle that does that? No.
But you mean?
Here, it's yeah, just reflection. Yeah, specular reflection. Just you know, bouncing elastically.
Reorient the self-propulsion velocity.
Yeah, I change the sign of the normal component of the velocity.
But if you change the sign of the normal component of the velocity, yeah. I will still move parallel to the wall, right?
No. So if you're the dynamics which is tangent is fine, but just like the normal one, no, it would become like that.
So you're changing the head.
Yes. So.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for self-propelled particles. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, exactly. That's just.
You're defining that you have changed.
Yes. Yeah. That's the rule I choose. I'm not saying there's any physical model that does that. No.
So before you go on,
yes,
we all have a lot of questions. Does that discontinuity appear at me is equal to zero or the non-zero mean? If you say symmetry breaking, it should appear at me is equal to zero.
Yes, I think it does.
No, it goes.
I think it has to go to one, right? Not to zero.
Yeah, to one.
Yeah. I think it goes to one. I didn't check that. The relaxation time diverges when it goes to zero. So that's
yes. If you have this, you said that you have this concentration factor of the.
Yes.
So you better get this picture. It seems to me it should be 100%.
No.
Because I mean, essentially all the particles. All the particles coming from the right are reflected back. All the particles coming from the left are.
Yeah, but you know, some will aim correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, but these small gaps is just.
No, but that's a wrong way of modeling. That was actually what was done in the initial paper, and it doesn't work quantitatively. What you should say here, is that if I want to model this, what I have to say is I forget about my obstacles. And I just say that these guys, what they do is they induce backward tumble, right? So what I say is that I have my cavity, and in the middle I put a stripe. And in this stripe, I say I have an enhanced tumbling rate when I come from left, which makes me go back to right. You compute this by simply looking at the frequency of collision with the apices. You put it in a model in which your tumbling rate is indeed not isotropic, and you get back the good numbers. Roughly a bit of numbers. So indeed it's...
So the picture is missing that there can be tumbling events during your...
Yeah, so the blue could tumble and go back here.
Turn around before it actually reaches.
Yes, and also the red can, you know, aim correctly in the games. And indeed, you're right that there is, you know, another guy here, and if these guys tumble and go here, then we will keep on going. So there is I think there was a noiseless simulation of this by Leuven et al. In which, in this case, of course, then you trap everyone. For a single trap, but with a tumble. And then, indeed, if your initial condition is not finely tuned, yes.
What's the role of the gap size?
What's the role of the gap size? It controls the efficiency of this asymmetric induced tumble, collision-induced tumble.
It depends on the gap size.
Yeah, it does.
Yes.
So
to have the ratio between density and left and right, you said that it depends on the anisotropy that you added in the probability of tumbling.
Yes.
So, and you said that matched the experiment was kind of a coincidence.
No, that was not. That you measure the frequency of collisions in the simulation with the abysses, and then you work backward.
There was a free parameter in order to make it coincide.
So in this model, if you want, I take a tumbling probability. Okay, I don't remember exactly the detail, but if I say that my tumbling rate is something like alpha naught, 1 minus epsilon cosine theta or something like that, then I'm just saying that my frequency of tumbling depends on the direction in which I'm going, and then I have a free parameter, which is and that you just say you count the ratio of tumbles in one direction, and that's what gives you alpha. But it's not quantitative, because of course it's much more complicated than that in reality, but the way you have to think about the effect of the obstacles is that they induce asymmetric tumbles.
But then it means that hydrodynamics and all these things may play a role, because you have a parameter that you adjust such that for your model it gives the same.
I think the hydrodynamics play a very important role, because it tells you what you do when you're close to a wall. So, for instance, whether you get stuck in the apices or not. Apart from that, I don't think it makes a huge difference. But it's really the closed field hydrodynamics that you do when you're in
the
corner.
The fact that they are particles
The particle-particle interaction not too important. One thing that you see when you look at this movie is that you really see that the rod arrives here, and if you were just to say, there is a torque, there is a reaction force by the wall that makes a torque, it rotates, it aligns, you wouldn't be too wrong.
What do they do when they arrive at the end of, in the blue line?
Yeah.
If they follow the wall, they would, go back, before that.
Yes.
Here.
Yes.
They would follow it.
No.
Well, yes, if the obstacle is such that, it's a finite size wall, then it would go around if it follows. So you have another rule somehow.
No, here, so my rule is just that it goes straight. So your question is, if you have an angle like that and you have a bacterium which arrives here, does it turn like that or does it keep on straight?
Right. So yeah, in your rule.
Yeah, so my rule is that it keeps on straight.
Okay.
I think in the experience it also does that. In principle,
it's interesting to compare to.
But you're right, that people who say that there are traction with the walls because of hydrodynamics could argue that at least if it's big enough, you would have a tendency to just just do that endlessly. But I don't think they would.
Get very stumble.
Okay, I have no clue on time, but really bad, no? 10 minutes, okay. Okay, I'll skip one part. So, motility-induced phase separation. So now I want to turn to collective effect. And before I tell you what this is, I have just like two slides to explain hand-wavingly what's going on. So when you take these self-propelled particles, whatever they are doing with the directions, typically in the master equation, you have one term which is like that. You have an advection term. Now, if everything is isotropic, and you're looking for a steady state distribution, you can always look for something which does not depend on theta. And these terms typically give 0 plus 0. So that's then just not there, and you're left with this. And so a steady state distribution is simply p proportional to 1 over v. That was already worked out by Schnitzer for the random ensemble case. And that should be very generic. It's true for active boson particles, true for random particles. In this isotropic case, you get that. What this means is that if somewhere you go slower, you'll be denser. Now, if, and that's a big if, whatever interactions are between the particles result in a velocity which depends on the local density. And if this velocity goes down, typically, as I mentioned in the next slide, steric interaction, then you can get a feedback loop. Imagine you start to an initially flat density rho naught with a velocity v of rho naught, and you make a small perturbation. Because here you're denser, and because if you're denser, you get slower, you get anticorrelation between the perturbations of the velocity and the density. But now, I've told you that I tend to relax towards 1 over v. So here, v is lower, so we'll tend to increase the density of particles which were here. Here is v higher, so we'll tend to decrease it, which means that these things can be enhanced. And this, in turn, will even create this, and you get a feedback loop, and you get phase separation. So that's very hand-waving. Actually, one thing which is a bit surprising is that if you try to compute this new perturbation, you can simply, you're not allowed to do that, you should resolve the dynamics, but simply say, well, I will go to 1 over this new v. 1 over this new v, again, I make an expansion in small delta rho, I get a new density profile which is like that, and then I compare this and that, and I simply said, well, if this is larger than 1, I've amplified my perturbation. So that would give me a kind of linear instability criteria. And this instability would then lead to phase separation. Very surprisingly, this is actually quantitatively correct, as I will show in a second. And yes.
To comment, you probably know this, but in viscous polymer solutions, you get exactly the same.
In viscous?
Viscous polymer solutions. And near a critical point, you get the same. If concentration and viscosity are coupled in this way, you can also get
Okay, there is one thing which, so, because in equilibrium, so typically we say that cannot happen with colloids and viscosity, the reason being that you have the Boltzmann distribution which is not sensitive to the viscosity, just the temperature. So if the temperature remains flat, you should keep flat. But that would be interesting. I don't know anything about polymers, so I will be very happy to learn about that.
All
these effects, you can find them in liquid crystals or polymer liquid crystals when you shear them or when you do the naturally close analysis.
So, no, just one. Why use V of rho? That's not what I wanted to say. Because it's biologically motivated, of course. And the best example of that is quorum sensing. So we have bacteria, they can produce small proteins, they can feed proteins produced by others, adapt their gene expression level and change what they're doing. And at the end, I won't have the time to tell you about that, but there is an example. Another reason, because of the physics, is because it's the mean field approximation of steric interactions. So there are two ways of seeing that. If you are true believers, once in your life you've worked on totally asymmetric exclusion process, and then you know in this model that at mean field level, the velocity decay linearly with density. But actually, you can simply do a very simple mean field argument. Imagine that you are an active particle, and that around you there is a well-mixed density of other particles, and at every time step you open your eyes, if there is no one in front of you, you do a step, V0 dt, otherwise you don't do anything. So if there is someone in front of you, that happens with a probability which is proportional to local density. I call mu the constant of proportionality, I have no clue what mu is. And then my position next time is the same as before. If there was no one, probability 1 minus mu rho, then I've made my step. If I compute the average velocity from these things, I get a simple linear decay. So on lattice, it's very simple to work that out. Off lattice, it's very difficult. I haven't done that. And these guys have, and argue for the same type of linear dependence. And here, what mu is something a bit complicated. Yes.
Would you really call this quorum sensing? I mean, usually quorum sensing relates to quorums. And for me, this is more like chemotaxis.
No, chemotaxis sense gradients.
Yeah.
This is sensing density.
Yeah. But you also say quorum sensing relates to velocity?
So the example, well, the quorum sensing sense, you know, the local density. And then the bacteria changes whatever cryogenetic circuits are doing.
For instance, the biologists would not use even more
restricted. You know. So the biologist, which you know, did the paper at the end about when this is not the velocity which changes but the tunnel frequency, called that quorum sensing. I don't know anything about biology, so you know I'm happy to not argue about that. Okay, just one. Well, you remember at the beginning I told you. If you have just different equation, you fine-tune your microscopic parameters, of course you can get the same D. What is very surprising is that actually you also get the same drift. So I start from microscopic master equation, I do coarse graining, these are the two terms I have, so that's my diffusion constant, which I had before. This is a drift term, and you see it's proportional to the grain of the velocity. So hot colloids don't have velocities, they don't have this guy. But random tunnel particles and active random particles, if I take this equal to that, so that the D are the same, I get at the same time that the Vs are the same. And so I just don't have the same qualitative large-scale picture, I have the same quantitative large-scale picture. And just to insist on the fact that this is very surprising, if I make any modification to my macroscopic dynamics, it just doesn't exist anymore. So if I have finite duration tumble, I cannot map at the same time these two dynamics. So there is a mapping between these two classes of particles, which is very surprising to my mind. One thing which is nice about these guys is that the dynamics, the current, derives from a free energy. So it's actually, at this level, is mapped to an equilibrium level. If I take my diffusion term and my drift term, I can actually write it like that. I'm using abusively free energy here because, of course, this is a finite temperature effect. So I would need also to compute the noise term here, write down a Fokker-Planck equation, check that the free energy is the steady state. We've done that. It works. That's in the 2008 paper. So it's really a free energy. And then that's, even though I'm looking at a non-thermal effect, which has no counterpart for hot colloids, I have the same machinery in the sense that if I'm interested in steady state, I can look at my free energy, look at its shape, is it concave, is it not?
Now, how could you interpret the dimensions here? What I mean is, I mean, you should have an equal to 1, 5.
Yes.
You know,
it's like depletion, there's no temperature. Why isn't there a temperature here? Or what?
Well, no, I mean, how do you actually interpret the dimensions? You're really trying to make an analogy with equilibrium.
So this is, okay, so this is the part which has no linear flow in it, so that's just the non-entropy.
That's it, yeah. Yes.
The log V here is what would play the role of the attractive forces.
I understand this, but the reason I'm asking is that if you were to try to actually go beyond this, and instead of just using a real gas to actually get some interaction, repulsion or attraction, then you actually will run into the question of what to do with the three factors. You have set equal to 1 everywhere.
No, I have not set equal to 1. I've put it in the mobility. That's the same. And the thing is that I don't have the choice because it's the noise term which tells me what should be there. If I want that my dynamics really has this guy as a steady state, in principle I have to work with the noise term, and the noise term is a variance, and what I have to have here is the variance of the noise term.
Normal physics, you do linear extensions in order if I.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly.
So can this be done for this new part? I mean, with a density extension, no?
Mm-hmm. You don't know, you don't get it from then. So the problem is that I don't know how to expand our mean field. So you know, this is really I do the mean field treatment of my interactions to end up with the V of rho. So, with the V of rho. And the thing is that in principle, to go beyond this level, I need to do two things. I need to go higher order in gradients. No, sorry, where is it? Higher order in gradients here, right? And I don't know what to do with the terms then. And I need to say that I don't really have a truly local functional here. Mm-hmm. And I need to do a non-local expansion of VFO. Mm-hmm. And then I get terms and they break the mapping with the free energy. So, and the question is, you know, does this has any impact on the steady state or not? But it's.
I think the question is slightly different in the sense that, you know, if you were to try to push this map. mapping, which is very nice, beyond the ideal gas. You have your ideal gas piece and your ideal rock. Then you have to start worrying about things like Julian expansions.
Yes, yeah, I know, I understand. Right. Yeah, I
and then, then there is actually an issue that comes up, which is has to do with prefactors, as a matter of fact, and with the fact that then you have a strength of the interaction, and you don't know how to merge these things with your real growth.
Yeah, and I haven't tried, so that would be a short answer. But what I can tell you is that if you do the rest of the things I was mentioning, the higher burden expansion, you have the same problem that things you would like to do in this prefactor don't, and you end up with terms which do not derive with free energy. But anyway, so at this level you have this, you can do everything you want. So you can look for linear stability of this. You can look at when the second order derivative of your free energy becomes negative. You get a criterion which is exactly the same as the one I had before with my argument. But you can do more than that. You can compute coexistence density and speak about phase separation. These are two snapshots of microscopic simulations of run and tumble and active brilliant particles. And you see that they do basically the same. They cannot be distinguished. It's quite difficult to go to large scale. So here there are 10,000 particles. It's difficult to go much beyond that. We wanted to know if really, you may have noticed that there are no gradient terms here. And the gradient terms are the one which dominates the coarsening, so they're important. To know whether they were there, we basically went back on the lattice gas model of frontal bacteria. Then you can use excluded volume interactions. And here you get coarsening and phase separation. So you have the picture. So here, every time time takes one decade, they multiply the speed by 10. You start with something which is completely homogeneous. That's 1,000 times 1,000 system. There is like 6 million particles here. Before, I was showing you a 40 by 40 boxes. And you can see it takes quite some time, but you really have a coarsening. And when you look at this, it really looks like the coarsening you get for typically conserved order parameter system in equilibrium. And at the end, you'll see really Oswald coarsening and all these things. There has been some debate about whether the exponent is the same as the equilibrium exponent or not. It was found to be a bit lower in simulations of lattice. Here in the simulations, initially they are a bit lower, and then it seems to converge to a good one. So whether this is just a finite size effect or not, in 3D it seems to work fine, so it's a bit confusing situation. You can see. And you get the exponent that which is predicted is 1/3. So you can see initially it seems to be a bit lower, and then when you get that large size, it seems to fit fairly neatly, and the rescaling works fine. I think these were these were really microscopic simulations with real interactions. I think they were the first simulations of really microscopic models with repulsions. In experiments, the first results there were the colloids in Lyon. Here they have finite size cluster, but what this picture is not telling you is that this thing is sedimenting. So what they're doing is that here you have a continuous phase, which is like a solid phase. Here you have a gas phase, and you look in the middle and you have these finite size clusters. It's not clear if it's a bulk property or if it's just that you're seeing the ones which are not too heavy and which haven't fallen down. It's a very difficult experiment. They have been written in YU and there. They were saying they don't have coarsening. When I look at that, initially you have lots of small clusters. At the end of the simulation, you have bigger clusters. So, as far as that, no. So the problem is that the what gives them the self-propulsion also could give them attraction, and I say could because this hasn't been measured. So it's. It's quite complicated to know whether what you're seeing is like the effect of attractive forces, of the motility of phase separation, the combination of the two. Okay. And,
if I understand correctly, they have this sort of corona around them. Yeah. All the flows have to, so how large is this?
It hasn't been measured. I mean, as far as I know, it hasn't been measured. So that's what they say. But if the experience, what they show, that the reason why they say there should be an attraction is that if you prefer gradients, and put a colloid in the gradient of H2O2, then you see it moving downwards or upwards. But they haven't really resolved the two-body interaction. I think it's very difficult. So I was at the PG defense of Isaac, and you could see from time to time you have like big cluster, and one particle going straight to it, perfectly straight, you know, no bending, nothing. So where are the instructions in this case? Probably at this time there were no gradients because everyone is trying to set up his own gradients, and whether this guy sends to really long large scale interactions is not obvious. I think it's a very complicated system. But anyway, so yeah, so that's the quorum sensing system. These guys have bacteria that produce some proteins. You feel the proteins. The result is here, so diffusion constant versus density. You see that initially it's flat and then it drops. If you look at the patterns you have, they don't look like motile-induced respiration, which means that there is one ingredient missing. So you have this sequence of rings which establish. So what happens with these guys experimentally is that it's not their propulsion speed which decreases with density, it's their tumbling rate, tumbling duration, which increases with density. So they spend more time tumbling. You can work out again diffusion drift in this case with finite duration tumble. You get exactly the same type of equations, diffusion constant that can become negative. You can get multi-induced phase separation. The big difference actually between these experiments and what I said earlier, and I will conclude on this, is that here you cannot neglect cell division and death, because the time scale is like a week of the experiment. And so in addition to the motility-induced separation bit, you need to have a logistic term. The logistic term, what it does is that it kills people in the high density phase. It creates matter in the low density phase. To reach steady state, you select a given size. You don't get phase separation, you get micro phase separation. So these dots do not grow anymore. And I will just conclude on that. So if you start, as in the experiment, with a central inocular, and you had like the rings, you get the same in the simulations. And now we are in contact to see if we can make a quantitative match between these things. OK. Well, you don't need conclusion. And just I would like to thank my collaborators. So my case with where I worked on almost all these problems. Richard Blass and Davide Maranduzzo, who are both in University of Edinburgh. Ignacio Pagona Barraga, who's in Barcelona, and Rupert Nash and Alasdair Thompson were two PhD students who worked on many, many of these problems. Thanks for your attention.
I'm still struggling with biology. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what I don't really get is, so you're saying this quorum sensing case, the bacteria secrete something and get us a.
That's really
okay.
So you should make a theory with two components and do. And do fast variable treatments on the chemicals.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you end up with a V of rho, which is slightly non-local. So you don't have V of rho of X. You have V of, say, rho tilde of X.
Yeah.
And this rho tilde is a convolution. I mean, it's a convolution. Yeah. Of these things, and you do an expansion in the kernel size, and you end up with exactly the same thing per surface order gradient, which is like a surface tension term. So that's what we did in this case. So the that's what I mean. But you know, it's called quorum sensing because in practice, you know, it feels locally the density of cell. And that's, you don't want to be, if the bacterium were really feeling the density of the cells really, really far, then it wouldn't be that useful. Right? It's because also it gives them information locally that it's. But you're right that in principle you need to take into account creation of chemicals, diffusion.
But I guess one way to say
with
quorum that
these chemical signals, they degrade pretty rapidly,
yes.
Too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what keeps the locality.
Oh.
Yeah. So they're. Yeah, as soon as they're outside of the cell, they start degrading really fast.
Yeah, so one way to say is that all these models show that you can hide all of that physics in just one parameter,
mm-hmm.
which is the rate, yes. I think you call it lambda maybe, at which the velocity increases.
Yes.
And I don't know that there are any actual calculation of this.
So we did the fast variable treatments for the Murray paper, so it was another system, and we haven't written it for this one, but that's something that. I would like to do. But, also because there are, I mean, in the rings case, So everything I said before, you know, was kind of based on linear instability analysis. And in the ring case, it's really, you have a front. So you see that you have like this red front, so it's like a Fisher wave which propagates. And actually this front forces you to pass through the linear instability regions, and in the front you nucleate the patterns. So in terms of even pattern formation, it's not something quite standard. It's very interesting in dynamics, but we haven't made much progress with that. Terry will be some more on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.